Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin. Happy New Year. We've got the crew here, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, Jacob Kanzler, and the boss, John Rurink. A little later, Dave Crable, he is the communications director of iHemp, will be joining us to talk about industrial hemp. Also, we're going to have an update from the Genesee County Clerk, our favorite Irishman, Johnny Gleason, to give us an update on tomorrow's special election in the city of Flint to determine who the Democratic nominee in the 34th State House District is going to be. But first, guys, let's talk about a different State House District. We're going to talk about the 104th House District because the future of the Larry Inman recall is in the balance. And Mike, we were following this last week, and right now we have to determine if the Court of Appeals is going to allow the recall committee for Larry Inman to get their signatures properly challenged to the Bureau of Elections, if they're going to be allowed to proceed. Because right now, it's not very clear.
Right. What the recall committee wants to do is rehabilitate about 100 signatures. They fell short, according to the Bureau of Elections verification of signatures. And so they need to have the opportunity. But you know more about this than I do. They missed the deadline.
They missed the deadline of December 23 because they were too busy trying to get their actual petition language approved by the courts. And I guess they weren't able to do two things at once, Jacob. And now they're in this situation where this has been less than a smooth operation to try and recall Larry Inman.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Now the court is weighing in on the rules or the statute that the Bureau follows to do the whole signature process. You know, people who don't like the petition can challenge signatures, and then the committee that actually sponsored the petition can have a chance to kind of rebut that. And so there's usually a process with strict deadlines that kind of determine that. What I think is interesting is if the court does weigh in on this and, I guess, say that it's okay to rehabilitate now, I'm very interested to see what kind of precedent that sets for how the Bureau does operations and how campaigns can kind of address the challenges to their signatures in the future.
Yeah, because what's the criteria for saying, yeah, we're going to go ahead and let you bypass this deadline, but if other candidates down the line want to say, well, you know what, we missed the filing deadline of, you know, April 22 or whatever, but I filed the next day, I should still be allowed to do it. I don't know, John, you're shaking your head here. There's a problem with letting people break deadlines.
You can't. You just can't do it. You're right. You're opening up a Pandora's box. You're going to have to litigate every single questionable decision or any decision that goes adverse to a campaign. This is the group that can't shoot straight. They couldn't take a sample a signature sheet and just Xerox it and pass it around. They had to change it. They left out words. They created their own legal issues with them, with their own petition. I mean, you missed a deadline. They I'm sure, yeah, I haven't looked at all the documents, but I'm fairly certain that the Bureau of Elections informed them precisely of the date of the 23rd, and they just glossed over it.
I'll tell you, one group of people who do not want this recall to go forward is the House Republicans. The last thing they want to do is to see Larry Inman up for recall, because then they have a real tough situation on their hands, Jack. Do they go ahead and expel Larry Inman because they don't want Larry Inman up for recall? They changed the law after the Paul Scott recall back in 2011 so that Larry Inman would be the Republican nominee going up against one-on-one with a Democrat nominee. They're not going to win that.
They don't have the option of expelling him. They need Democratic votes to do it.
Obviously, Republicans need two-thirds in the House to expel Larry Inman. There's not enough Democrats who...
I can't imagine what penalty people, Dems, would pay in most of those districts for not going along with it.
Christine Gregg's already said that he should resign. There's several other Democrats, but you're saying for political purposes, they want the recall election, so they would not support an expulsion of Larry Inman at this point.
I'm just saying the Republicans can't do it right by themselves.
And saying he should resign is not saying we should vote to expel him.
What's your thoughts on this, Mike?
Well, definitely, you're right. The Republicans do not want this to go to a recall election. Inman barely scraped by in 2018. He won by 349 votes. If it goes to a recall election, he will lose. But I don't see how Democrats can vote against expulsion if it comes up. But I also don't see how Chatfield, Speaker Chatfield, calls for an expulsion vote at this point, not having moved for expulsion before his trial. Now, after they've had a hung jury, how does he call for that politically and move ahead with expulsion unless they get a second trial in before the time, and they can't?
It would look politically expedient when
if they do one. Gideon DeSandro will have to sharpen up his pencil and his rhetoric.
Because, yeah, it will look pretty politically expedient. The only thing that has changed between now and then is
you don't want this guy back up on the ballot because you could lose a seat, right? Mm.
And this is, yeah, and as we've mentioned here, this 104th district in Grand Traverse County is becoming more and more Democratic. It is trending that way, but I think the Republicans feel if they had somebody other than Larry Inman, they would have a pretty good chance of winning this seat back
well,
again.
Well, the solution would be for him to just resign. That's not going to happen, though, apparently. The Democrats, I mean, I have a hard time believing in most of their districts people are even paying attention to this. So I just see no reason to think that they would just go along, yeah, let's help the Republicans out. I guess that's what we feel like doing today. I just don't see it.
And if you're Larry Inman, I mean, think about it. He got a hung jury. He got a campaign that can't shoot straight. They screwed up the language in the petitions, and then they didn't have enough valid signatures. I mean, that's what, three political lives. Let's see how many more he's got, right?
Yeah, well, if he's a political cat, he still has a few more.
He's got six more lives. Let's go, baby.
Anyway, so Larry Inman may still serve out the remainder of his term yet just because of the way things worked out. And shoot, we don't even know if the federal government is going to be able to get the trial, get a second trial going. If, you know, that request, if they get things worked out, we don't even know that.
Given the way the first one went, if I were the U.S. attorney, it'd be on the bottom of my pile, right?
Yeah, talk about another group that couldn't seem to shoot straight. There's another one right there when you actually look at it.
We'll keep an eye out for Larry Inman. On one race that we do know that is going to be lock solid for 2020, Gary Peters and John James for the U.S. Senate. John James turned in his signatures several weeks ago. Over last weekend, we saw Gary Peters turned in his signatures. They're both going to be on the ballot. In a very unusual move, the Michigan Republican Party has already weighed in and has endorsed John James as its nominee. I don't ever remember seeing that before. Do you, John, before a primary getting involved in that?
I don't, but it doesn't mean it hasn't happened sometime in the past history.
What does this say?
We were at the Republican thing up on Mackinac in September, and you saw how he was received by the rank-and-file Republicans. I mean, he's like considered a rock star among Republicans, and he ran pretty good, better than expected against Stabenow, and clearly he's got the backing of the Donald Trump administration, and Republicans are ready to go. They've got their guy.
Well, that seems strange, though. I mean, the U.S. Senate primary, where this decision will be made, isn't until August. And they endorsed them back in, what, November, December? I mean, so it's several months. I mean, things could change, I suppose.
Well, it goes back to the question, does not having a primary help a candidate? Because you're not debating anybody. You're not in full contact, rhetorical debate with anybody, either across the media or on a stage. Is that going to help? Is that going to help them? Is it going to be sharper or duller because of that?
And you can look at this in any lens you want. On one hand, you can look at it as the confidence that the Republican establishment has in James as their candidate. There doesn't appear to be any public, and as far as we know, private second guessing of James. Kind of like what we're seeing in the Democratic presidential primary and past elections or whatever. So, but you can also see it in the lens of how much Republicans have to do to even try to get on a level footing to beat a Democratic incumbent senator. I mean, Debbie Stabenow barely had to, I don't think she ran anything negative against James, and he got a clap on the back for doing better than they hoped, which was still a loss. And so it shows how much they have to kind of tee it up to even make this a competitive race for Republicans to try to get a foothold in the U.S. Senate.
One thing that I'm going to be interested in seeing is how long it will take John James to do a round robin with media. Will that ever happen, yes or no?
Probably not. He is inexperienced, and he's had the opportunity to field questions. He doesn't show a lot of depth. I would think that James would avoid situations where he would be able to be examined in depth.
He can avoid it till late next summer when there's actually a U.S. Senate debate, maybe in front of the Economic Club in Detroit. And if he turns tail and runs without answering questions and leaves Gary Peters there to do a scrum with the available media, it's not going to look very good. It's not going to go over very well. So I think he can avoid it for a while, but I don't think he can avoid it for very long.
Well, Terri Land did avoid it. And the reason was it didn't seem like she did well when given the opportunity to talk with the media.
That's a little bit of an understatement, isn't it?
I guess so. Do you still remember those debates, the Gary Peters-Terri Land debate, the one that they did on public radio?
Yeah, she struggled considerably in that role. I personally, as far as James goes, I think generally speaking, they're caveats that you can say it might be different. I just think he either fails or succeeds depending on how Trump does.
Well, I don't think you're wrong on that. But I think that since John James has basically been the anointed candidate now for the Republicans, he's got several months to get himself ready for some media interaction. I think he's going to talk to the media at some point, and I think he's going to be better than he was when Tim Scubik ambushed him outside of the Bureau of Elections back in 2018 or 2017. I think he's got time to be better.
You can talk to the media in more controlled situations, and you can be really open and talk to the media in less controlled situations. And I think they may have a much smaller window for him to do it in anything that comes close to, you know, off the cuff kind of
interview. We've interviewed him. We sat down with him. He's very much capable of sitting down with the media and fielding conversations. I think there's a level of public policy knowledge that you have to be able to display in a U.S. Senate debate and in conversations with the media. I think he's capable of doing it. I just think he's got a little ways to go yet, especially when you line up against Gary Peters. Gary Peters has been in the political process since, the 90s, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been in politics for at least that long, which is something the Republicans will use against him as a career politician. So I think that he has time. I think he's got the ability. I think he'll be fine. But I think you're right that we're going to have a very controlled environment with John James for a little bit until it's ready.
Later this summer.
And he doesn't need to. I mean, that's the other thing, too. I mean, with the social media activity that we've seen from him and the other ways that candidates can communicate, they don't have to rely on the media like they used to. They can put out a Facebook message or a tweet, or they can call out a friendly reporter at Fox News or Breitbart or whatever you call it and get whatever you want out there.
And I remember the other dynamic, too, is outside groups. The Republicans have already been mounting the negative campaign against Gary Peters, who they've decided to, name him other things, like Jerry. Long story short, I mean, I think we're seeing that the Republicans are needing to take Gary Peters down a notch or two by going negative. And so you typically see outside groups do that talking for you. And so you already have them doing that. You have, James-friendly outside groups. You have the Republican apparatus who can do that speaking for you. And so you have that dynamic as well.
All right, one last thing I wanted to touch on was this, the fundraising numbers from Alyssa Slotkin, another $1.25 million allegedly raised in the fourth quarter. She's got close to $3 million in cash on hands. John, this looks like a U.S. Senate race, doesn't it?
I said that earlier. When I first started my career, $3 million, at this point in a campaign for the U.S. Senate would have been a nice haul, right?
She's running for Congress. What do you make of that, Jack?
Well, I mean, look at how much got spent on her last time. I mean, it was the all-time record for a congressional seat in Michigan. One part that I continue to question is, okay, it's supposedly a 56% Republican district. If that's true, I think she's going to have a lot of trouble. But that's the big question to me. Is it really a 56% Republican district?
I see at this point with the candidates that have announced on the Republican side and the headlines that we've seen from fundraising from Alyssa Slotkin, I think these fundraising numbers have the ability to serve as a deterrence. I think this is kind of like helping solidify her and maybe scare off anybody who wants to even consider the 8th in possibility, but for, you know, the Republican advantage when you look at the voting demographics.
Joining us on the podcast now is the clerk of Genesee County, John Gleason. Thanks for taking a couple minutes here with us.
Kyle, I'd do anything in the world for you. You're the best we got, baby.
Hey, I appreciate the compliment. So tomorrow is Tuesday. There's going to be a special primary election for the 34th State House District. That's the Sheldon Neely seat that was vacated when he became the mayor of Flint. It was a heck of a turnaround time for you guys in the Genesee County Clerk's office. And I know the choice of the date for January 7 was not yours, but tell our listeners what you guys did as far as trying to make this thing happen.
Well, first of all, the process was very shoddy. When you're going to impact a department that's as large as ours, this is a major county, almost 425,000 citizens in the core city of Flint, and there have been difficulties in past elections, and to just come out of not only the election, but we had just came to the conclusion of canvassing that election, then we were given a date. My biggest concern is if I'm going to impact somebody, I'm going to call them up and say, how is my decision going to affect you? I learned that just being in public office. I actually learned it at the dinner table when I'd asked my brothers or sisters to please pass me the potatoes. If I was going to have them do something, I should have given them the courtesy to be prepared for the action required. But anyways, we were given the directive without any communication from anybody in Lansing, which it did disturb me because I try to defend my office and, more importantly, my staff that really do the work, more so them than me. And just coming out of this very, very difficult, a lot of accusations were flying around in that mayor's race. We just wanted to draw breath, recover, rejuvenate, and then we'd ramp back up again. Even 1 week later would have been very helpful to us because it was impossible. We couldn't meet the mandate of the MOVE Act, the Military and Overseas Voter Act. We couldn't meet that date because that's 45 days before an election, which put us at the end of November.
Just for our listeners' benefit here, this would have been a special election for the primary. She set the date, the governor of the state of Michigan, Governor Whitmer, had set the date right after Sheldon Neely had resigned from office, become the mayor of Flint. They had to have the filing deadline a week later, and in order to meet this deadline that you're talking about to get ballots to folks who are overseas, it just literally couldn't happen. Is that what you're telling me?
No, it was impossible because we hadn't completed the canvassing. We were right on the cusp of concluding the canvassing for the mayor's race. And all of a sudden, then we're given a deadline, November 23rd, I believe it was, where we had to have the ballots in the hands of the overseas voters. And the ballots weren't even made. I mean, she literally gave us maybe a week to make the ballots, test the ballots, and it was just a date that could not be met.
So when were you guys able to get these ballots in the hands of the folks serving overseas?
Well, the only thing I can tell you wasn't when it was supposed to be by federal law, but we did it. We ramped up. We have a marvelous staff here. I know darn well we have the best election supervisor in the state, respecting all 83 counties. I figure we got the best. Doreen Falter is by far a person that people come to and consult with about how they can handle their own county businesses. And Doreen got our staff together and ramped up, and we just did what we could do. We did the absolute best anyone could do, and we got them in the hands. We consider ourselves responsible, and if we can't do something that we're supposed to do, we're not very proud of that. But we were put in an unattainable situation, but we did it the best we could. So after about around 30 days out, we started submitting the MOVE ballots. Now, well, you should take all laws into consideration. You know, even if she would have had a conversation with the Secretary of State, Benson, I'm sure Benson could have reminded her of the move ballots. But more importantly, I just think you have to use good manners.
Now, you served with Governor Whitmer in the state Senate. You guys were both in the Democratic caucus together. Surely you've got her number. Didn't you give her a call and give her a, you know, what the heck's going on?
Well, she has an intermediary. Scotty Barton handles that work for her. So they knew. I've got a few messages from my friends in Lansing that said, when they had approached her, that she said, hey, I understand John Gleason's not very happy with me right now. Believe me, it wasn't about her. It was about my own staff. I try to take care of my own four walls and take care of the business that I'm responsible for. What she did to our workers. Not only that, you got to remember, there's a city clerk and a city staff involved with this as well. And you have the candidates. The candidates literally had 3 days to go collect up to 400 signatures. Yeah. 3 days in the middle of winter. So every component of this exercise was affected in a bad way.
We're going to switch gears here a little bit, ask you to put on your political hat, because obviously you are very in tune to what's going on in Democratic politics in Genesee County. And there's many candidates who are running for this seat. And what are you seeing on the ground, and what do you expect to see on Tuesday?
Not a lot of activity, which is not unusual. First of all, you have many, many folks that head to the south. Remember, Flint, Michigan is a General Motors town with a lot of General Motors retirees. There is typically annually a migration to the warmer states. So that has been impacted. It's hard to reach those voters where you could even get them an absentee ballot. You know, when you could send them the application in the mail as a candidate, but then you have to have that application returned, then the ballot sent, and then the ballot returned by mail, so it's quite an exhaustive exercise. There's just not a lot of activity. There's nobody's going to deny this is not the best time of year to put yard signs in either. But we got a little bit unusual warm weather, but it's still difficult to put signs in the yard because of the frozen tundra.
Now, you can see the situation, though, that the governor is in that she wants to get this seat filled immediately. And, you know, we're going to have a presidential primary on March 10. It'd be great to have somebody in place after that. If you think about it, if the candidate, whoever wins this primary, is successful, as you would expect, on March 10, that seat could have only been empty for 4 months. It's a heck of a turnaround. It's a lot better than, let's say, under the previous administration, that seat would have probably been vacant for an entire year.
Not necessarily true. I have to remind your listeners that I went through that exercise. I gave up my Senate seat and ran for the clerk position, and that actually opened up the opportunity for a marvelous, a very, very good Democratic minority leader, Jim Ananick. He took my seat in the Senate, and that was turned around by spring as well. So we'd already been through this exercise. Your memory serves you well, which, my good man, I know it does. You remember I blistered Snyder for having that such a close window in that election cycle, too. They just need to talk. You know, if they would brought us in early and said, okay, how does this affect you? I respect my staff so much that when somebody gives them something unusual, without even having the courtesy to call, when we get a notice, and that, this is exactly how it was presented to me, I got a call from Whitmer's staff saying, a half an hour from now, the governor's going to announce the special election. I was never raised to treat people that way, and I don't think that's the best route to take. If the discussions were underway, which they had to be, they just didn't decide within a half an hour of announcing that they were going to do this. Why weren't the city clerk and myself invited to that discussion? How does this affect you? Okay, the city's in financial straits, the county maybe even worse. How is this going to affect your budget? Obviously, you're going to have to do some overtime. Then you got to go back to your county board, and she's got to go back to the city, I don't know, city council or mayor or someone and get some budgetary alterations. It was just a very discourteous way to do it. I really expected more, and I hope it gets better in the future.
Johnny Gleason, the Genesee County Clerk, just one more thing here before we let you go. Since turnout is probably going to be very light, as you've already indicated here, it seems like whoever wins this Democratic primary, it's really hard to gauge it then because you don't exactly know who's going to vote. Is it fair to call this primary race on Tuesday a jump ball?
No, I think there's some candidates that have great advisors. I mentioned to you a few weeks ago, I said, watch this Claudia Perkins. She actually was mobilized, and as I told you then, she actually fulfilled the obligation. She got 400 signatures in 3 days. She's never held public office. Very active, just a superhuman being. She's fought every fight she can for civil rights, workers' rights, women's rights in our community. And I think this may be her time. But she's been very aggressive. She's been to every church. She's been to every door that she can be. I think she's ran the most aggressive campaign, and I think that she really could be the surprise. Obviously, Neely's got a tremendous advantage being the mayor. He has an opportunity, you know, to put unusual pressure on funders, potential contractors that want to do work in the city. You know the political process better than I do.
Sure.
And then also, you still have the remnants of the Weaver team. And I think, like most people, that the last thing that they would like to have is another Neely in office, since they just went through a pretty bruising campaign between the Neely and Weaver teams.
Sure.
I think the Weaver team would do everything they could to deny that seat to a Neely. And so I think there's probably three people that I would suggest at the top. I would be Claudia Perkins, Weaver's candidate, Carissa, and I don't remember her last name right now, and then I think, obviously, Mrs. Neely. I think that would be considered the three potential winners.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that, and I appreciate you giving us update. Genesee County Clerk, Johnny Gleason, thanks for the time.
Hey, God bless you, my brother. Bye-bye.
Join us now at MERS World Headquarters as the Communications Director for iHemp, Dave Crable. Thanks for joining us up here. Appreciate it, Dave.
My pleasure.
So, do you grow hemp?
I did this last year. I grew an acre of hemp.
So, what does it look like out in the field? Is it just like, does it look like corn or cotton? What the heck does it look like?
It looks like marijuana. It's cannabis sativa, so it looks exactly, it's a tree. It almost looks like a Christmas tree, because they grew 6 to 7 feet high. They would have a 3 to 4 inch base, you know, the stalk, which is where you get the fiber from the plant. And, you know, it's bushy. They bush out about five feet.
Did anybody steal your hemp?
Not in the field. They did after one of my partners invested a lot of labor into trimming. We're going down a rabbit hole, but
no, I'm interested in this because I'm trying to picture what this looks like. So I'm picturing like big corn stalk kind of things. Could you like do a corn maze in a hemp field?
You certainly could.
Could you really?
Especially if you grew the genetics for fiber. Those the fiber plants can grow 12 to 16 feet high.
Boy, so you could do like a maze, a hemp field.
And people have. I've seen that ever. I don't know if in Michigan, but I have seen that. You know, and certainly in Michigan, I know there's some fields they would love to set that up because they didn't have a good experience, you know, and be able to pull everything off the field. So they need a second use for their crop, unfortunately.
Well, you'd probably get people like trying to pull the hemp off the bush or the tree or whatever, though. I mean, you'd have to maybe say, well, you can't, you know, take stuff with you after you leave, right?
Right. You know, and it's interesting, you know, you bring that up. Pennsylvania and Michigan handled the research this year differently. In Michigan, we handled it under the marijuana laws, in a sense, and they kept all the grower locations private. And that caused a problem that we couldn't get. The state was unable to connect the growers with the processors, because if you're going to grow for CBD oil, you need someone with some investment in equipment to process it into oil. Pennsylvania did it differently, and they published everyone's location. So you had farmers in Pennsylvania that were getting raided every night. They had to have armed security out there. People were treating this as if it were a high-value marijuana crop and coming in with U-Haul trailers and stealing plants.
Really? So they come with like machetes and just like take stuff away?
Yeah, yeah.
There'd be some seriously disappointed thieves though once they realize what they had. I mean, well, you got rope, right? I mean,
I think a farmer got run over. He got hit by a vehicle. I mean, there was shots fired. I mean, this is like the wild, wild west out there in Pennsylvania. We've had some theft issues. One of our IHEP members and volunteers, Mary McGraw, she had some theft. They sold about 400 plants out of the field. And I don't know if they think this is marijuana because it looks just like marijuana.
Oh, or, does it?
But, you know, it's the price per pound is significantly less. So, or if they actually knew what they were getting and just wanted that CBD value.
So you don't want your addresses broadcast like they did in Pennsylvania?
No, and but that's what we've done is, you know, through IHEP Michigan as an association is we've used our communications tools to connect those processors and growers together. So we're able to solve that puzzle as an association and work with MDARD, which has been great to work with to get that collaboration going and get all the pieces of the puzzle together.
How many farmers grow hemp now?
So in 2019, we had 550 grower permits, which it only costs $100 to get a grower permit. And you have to put the GPS locations of where you want to grow. And they had over 900 locations, you know, for growing throughout Michigan. And the size of the grow varied greatly. You know, everything from, you know, a quarter of an acre to 300 acres this year.
Is this easy to grow? Is it like drought resistant, rain resistant, or, you know, like I think of it as a weed, and weeds seem to grow no matter what. Is that what they're like?
You know, a lot of people told us that in the beginning. It's not really true. You know, I was having some conversations. Christy Apple, one of our agronomists that's going to be speaking at the Midwest IHEMP Expo this Friday and Saturday at the Lansing Center, she made the statement, I was down with her in Indiana at the Hemp at the Crossroads, and I really love this. She says, the plant demands your attention. And that's what I, you know, especially for a CBD grow, it demands your interaction with the plant. You know, it's a plant that's been in the culture of every indigenous people for thousands of years. You know, but unfortunately, it's been unavailable to us for the last, 80 years because of prohibition. So it's interesting to see it coming back in all the ways. We learned a lot this year. The Midwest IHEMP Expo this weekend is our way to get all those resources together to be smarter for the 2020 growing season.
Well, when you say that it demands a lot of attention, what do you mean? That you need to make sure that it's watered enough, but not too much, that it gets enough sunlight, but not too much sunlight. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so some of the challenges we had this year is that there aren't any approved pesticides to use with the plant. And most people that are into hemp aren't the type that would want to use any type of chemical pesticides anyhow. But, you know, the moisture is a big concern, especially here in Michigan. So ideally, if you're growing for CBD, you need to get out there and actually trim up the plant some, get it some more air. Some do some techniques where they're, you know, topping it and trying to maximize the flower production, you know, reduce some of the weight of the plant to you know, focus more on specific production. To do it right, you want to go out there and sample some tissue from the plants and determine what nutrients it's pulling up. You know, it's a double-edged sword. This plant is used for remediation of soil, so it'll pull up any heavy metals, any toxins in the soil. It's used to clean soil. So we could take it in the Flint area where I'm from and grow it in places where GM has been active and help remediate that soil. But at that same point, if you're growing for some type of human consumption, you don't want those toxins in that plant. So, you know, you have to monitor all those things, and then that comes down to the whole processing side where a lot of that can be remediated out as well.
As the Association for Hemp Growers, obviously you're focused on Lansing in the public policy process. What issues do you want lawmakers to know about that? I mean, why should they care about hemp?
Just to give you an idea, you know, we're we're creating a brand new industry. I mean, this is, I think it's unprecedented. We have a whole industry coming together. One of our exhibitors at the expo, Labuddy, I was speaking to them. They offer drying operations for farmers for beans and other grains. He says he started drying for some hemp farmers in the Thumb. There's a lot of growing going on in the Thumb. And he's talking about investing another $10 million in another dryer in the Thumb for hemp. You know, that's just one small example of the amount of investment that's coming into this industry. This plant can be used for textiles, plastics, medicine, food. I mean, there's a lot of uses. So we're just doing the tip of the iceberg with this CBD craze right now. You know, we see a lot of uses coming down the road, you know, and it's going to be great for our environment and our ecology or our economy. We need the legislators to understand the impact this will have on our nation and why Michigan should be a leader, because we have both the manufacturing base and our agricultural farming base to pull all these pieces of the puzzle together.
Given what you just said there, what do you see as kind of the potential for the hemp industry in Michigan? Because, you know, Michigan's a very diverse crop state. So given what you know about, you know, Michigan and how hemp is grown and the interest in it, I mean, is this going to be kind of like a niche area, or do you see this getting really big where we see this as a big driver of agricultural economy in Michigan?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jacob. So we have a couple of things going on this year. You know, we have a lot of craft growers coming up that are going to be vertically integrated to come up with their own CBD product lines. But ultimately, we see the big market in large-scale fiber production, fiber and grain. That's going to overtake this market. You know, there's so many uses for this plant. We just need the infrastructure, decortication, that hemp fiber, that stalk, that outer fiber is stronger than steel. They're using it in a lot of uses. Graphene, if I don't know if you're familiar with graphene, they're using it in supercapacitor technology, but they found that they can use this fiber works well to create graphene, which is going to help our battery technologies be more affordable. You know, as you can see, you know, we're an automotive state, right? They don't make sedans anymore. You know, it's crossovers or trucks. They're all going to be electric, you know, for the crossovers and such. You know, trucks, I'm sure there's still going to be some gas burners. And the battery technology is a big deal. You know, if hemp fiber can be used to reduce the cost of those batteries, I mean, that's going to be a big play. I have a member who has the technology setting up, and he's doing it in other areas, even in Italy, where they can grind the inner part of that stalk is called the herd, and it's kind of like a woody pulp. He can grind it fine enough and dry enough to be used in an existing injection molded plastics. And he has the formulas. He can go up, you know, 10 to 30% of this hemp filler within existing plastics. Europe has a ban on single-use plastics in effect by 2021. So this whole plastics industry, which is, I'm not sure the number, it's like 100 billion, it's a big industry, the plastics. We see hemp being a way for greener plastics to offset some of those oil-based liquors they're called for that plastic. So,
like in The Graduate, when he said plastics, that's just maybe way, way old at this point to the idea that plastics is the future. How do you see this? Do you see there being hemp farmers and then there's a chain where different entities buy from the farmer? Or do you see them farmers actually do more like they actually, we grow this crop and this is what we turn it into? What direction is that going to take?
That's a great question. So the investment it takes to do like the decortication at scale to separate those fibers is huge. That's not going to be the farmer doing that. You know, some farmers are setting up some processing for CBD oil because you can do that at a smaller scale for, you know, maybe $100,000, $200,000. But, you know, for what we see happening, we need some serious capital investment. And that's one of the challenges we have right now. These hemp farmers can't even open up a bank account in many cases. You know, we've been blocked from opening banking accounts, if you have anything to do with hemp, even though the Federal Reserve has put out letters saying, hey, this is a real thing, you can work with these guys. It's very slow to happen. You know, and if the farmer wanted to advertise or market his crop or product, you can't advertise on Google, you can't advertise on Facebook, you're censored. You know, so there's a lot of education that we're focused on doing as an association, and that's a big part of the Midwest IHEMP Expo, this Friday and Saturday, is to bring all those resources, bring all those government agencies together. You know, the USDA is going to be there, and of course MDARD, which has been super supportive in this whole process, to bring everyone up to speed on what this industry is about.
And the expo is when and where?
It's Friday and Saturday at the Lansing Center.
Dave, I wanted to go back onto your background a little bit. Have you always been a farmer?
No, I'm not a farmer. I grew an acre this year because I wanted to understand it better. I got involved in this with a friend of mine, John Freeman. He's a Marine, retired from long civil service. He's an environmentalist. He needed some help. I got involved. I have a small marketing agency. I work on things that I enjoy and have passion for, and I love this community. You know, it's the farmers are absolutely fantastic to work for. These are the salt of the earth. They want to learn. They want to share. It's just been a joy to work with them. So I'm all in. I see this industry, in hemp in general, as being, I'm glad the reference to the Mr. Robinson with the plastics, because I think hemp's the word now. It's coming.
So CBD has come up a few times, and maybe a lot of people don't realize the connection between CBD and hemp. The general public, I think this is one of the areas that maybe the hemp industry touches the general perception of people, because if you drive around anywhere, CBD seems to be available everywhere. So can you kind of give us an update on kind of how CBD regulation works, and is there any kind of public safety or public health issue with how available it is? I mean, you can buy this at Quality Dairy and like Family Video of all places.
You know what's interesting, like that Family Video, there's a story behind that. You know, the owner of Family Video found that CBD helped with some medical issues that he wasn't finding help otherwise, so he wanted to make that available to his customers. And besides, I'm sure he needs to have another product to sell, than running videos. Buyer beware. Do your research. Look at the lab results. So if it's done right, like I grew an acre and I have about 7 liters of CBD distillate. It looks like honey, just pure CBD. I've sent that out to a couple of independent labs and I have my test results. So my intent is to sell some CBD to others who will package it into products, but I'm also going to offer some of my own products, and that's where I see myself fitting more, is to have a very transparent process and offer some products to the market where people can be comfortable in knowing that they're not getting something that's going to be harmful. There are some bad operators out there, so just like with this vaping issue, CBD has been consumed and is still consumed in vaping products as well. But it's not the good operators that are causing the problem. It's these few outliers that are causing some major issues.
I'm curious now, the problem you mentioned with the not being able to advertise, et cetera, that's because the federal government hasn't changed their laws. Is that correct?
No. So industrial hemp was made legal by the 2018 Farm Bill. So I really can't explain why Facebook and Google are so far behind the curve. I think they're just running scared, with this, all the controversy that they've had and, with the politics. I think they're just being extremely cautious.
Is there any possibility there's some big money holding things up, some people that want to get the advantage on this kind of stuff? Are you concerned about that kind of thing at all?
That's a great question. That's one of the things I have a challenge with our membership and discussions, because we have, the smaller operations that grows, we have some great members that are doing things right, and they're going to be vertically integrated. But we also need that large-scale farming operation, and that brings in a different element and some capital, which we need. But, certainly big pharma, big tobacco, big oil, Down in Texas, they have a lot of things going on in Texas. Michigan needs to get on the ball and put some investment in this. You know, the Texas oil energy companies are investing in hemp and the decortication. They see the potential for the oil and the fiber.
Mike, you mentioned the issue of banking, and the Farm Bill made it legal. How do you account for the fact that banks are so slow to catch up to this?
It comes down to the fact that it's so close to marijuana. I mean, looks like, smells like, acts like. I mean, industrial hemp is just a legal definition for cannabis sativa. It's 0.3% THC or less, so it's not an intoxicant, but it's all about managing risk. So if a bank has any dealings with marijuana, there's a lot more compliance expense on their side. So that's the problem. But I've seen these letters come out from the Federal Reserve say, hey, you know, if you deal with industrial hemp, it's not in this marijuana bucket, it's over in this industrial hemp bucket. But I think that's coming, you know, but it's just been slow, you know, for it to happen.
How much hemp, industrial hemp, would you have to smoke to get high?
It's not possible.
Oh, is that right? You'd just get sick before you would get high?
No, you wouldn't get sick, no.
Oh.
There's nothing harmful.
Your lungs would give out.
Yeah.
So when you say that it looks like and smells like, so just for the layperson walking by, let's say there's an industrial hemp field on the left side of the road and a marijuana field on the right side of the road, how would you be able to tell the difference?
You couldn't.
Really?
You could not. It's all about the genetics. And that's what, you know, at the Midwest iHemp Expo, we have different sources of genetics and seeds available for the farmers. It was Ready, Fire, Aim in 2019. You know, we struggled to get genetics and seeds and figure out what to grow. To give you an idea, I planted by hand 3,000 plants. I had to pull over 900 males out of the plant because you don't want them to be pollinated. Because once they pollinate, they go to seed, and it lowers the CBD production. So as part of that process.
So you're like neutering them.
Well, you remove the males from the field, yeah. But see, here's the thing is I should have pulled 903. I missed three.
Oh.
So it's like, where'd you come from? I just walked by you. You know, so the genetics are so important. So anything industrial hemp, it should be 0.3% or less. And this opens up a whole other topic, which regards to the legislation. These farmers are taking incredible risk by growing this crop because if they go over 0.3, they have to destroy their entire crop. You can get genetics that are predisposed not to go over 0.3% THC, which is the intoxicant. And in reality, if you grew any kind of cannabis sativa that had even up to 3% THC, it's not going to have any value as recreational marijuana. Mm. You know, you have to get up, you know, over 5%, 7% before you would really feel an effect from smoking that. So these farmers are at a lot of risk, you know, of losing their entire crop. We need to move that number up. It was an arbitrary number, the 0.3% to begin with.
What should it be? 0.5? 0.4?
I'd like to see it at 3%, but I mean, you know, so let's ask for that and compromise.
Dave Crable from the iHemp Communications Director. Thanks for coming on the MERS Monday podcast. It's been a great conversation.
A lot of fun. I really appreciate the invite. I'd love to come back again and talk.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Dave Crable for coming in and for delivering us these nice little parting gifts. He gave us all little trial samples of CBD oil for various,
ailments and bothers.
Or whatever we need. If we need energy, we take potion one. If we need focus, we take potion two. Relief, potion C. And sleep, potion D, John.
I'm going to try the sleep one tonight.
Well, Dave didn't actually, we actually didn't get to ask him what happens when you take all these at the same time.
Oh, you're going to be very confused.
No. Well, try it after work, okay? Don't try it during work. I have a feeling that, all right, so John, you'll take the sleep one tonight. Are you going to take the energy one right before the consensus revenue estimating conference on Friday?
Yes.
Okay. And we may need a focus, the focus at some point. And after another Democratic debate, we may need the one that says, I need relief. That's
possibly,
very
possible. Possibly. But yeah, focus. That's a tough one because there's sometimes you want to tune out and there's other times you want to focus.
Well, then you take D, right? So you're just not off.
Yep. And you just take the sleep one. He did warn us that you only want to take the I need sleep one right around bedtime or you're going to be in trouble.
You'll be in trouble.
All right. Do we dare take one now?
I would think it wasn't a good idea, but...
You think so?
I mean, we should clarify if anyone thinks that we're acting goofy. We have taken none of these at this point.
We have had a lot of coffee, though.
Well, yeah.
You know, you could pick one of us to be the guinea pig, and the rest of us could observe. That would be another way.
Yeah, you're it.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
We'll do the focus one, because, yeah, I'm going to be about ready to... Okay, so I'm going to crack... Ooh, something's leaking down here. I guess I'll taste it. Oh, weird. Hmm. I don't know. I feel like I've just tasted some kind of like cooking oil or something.
Tastes like pot?
I don't know. It tasted like a little minty kind of thing here. Just a second here. Oh, God, it's running down my shirt. Ah!
Put it in your mouth.
Ah!
Fortunately, hemp also works as a
bacteria. I should probably read the directions.
for our listeners who are confused, Kyle has a little...
Avoid spilling it across in front of you.
Kyle has a packet in his hand, and there's been some oil leaking out.
I was supposed to snap and squeeze under my tongue, not on my tongue, and I was supposed to hold it there for 30 seconds.
No, I always read the directions afterward. It's more fun.
Okay, well, I'm doing it now. I don't... There's nothing left to suck on, though, so I guess it kind of blew this. Well, there was only one focus, though. I'm not going to do the energy, dude. I don't need energy.
It smells pretty good in here.
You can get my focus.
Oh, Mike, you're so kind. No, I...
That's what everybody says about me.
Now I've got it all over my hands. What am I supposed to do with that? I don't want to stain my clothes.
You'll wash it.
Oh, jeez. Well, okay.
We can continue the long MERS podcast tradition of trying interesting things in the podcast.
Oh, all right, so I'll need to report next week if this focus actually worked. Hold on. Hold on, it's still on my tongue right now.
Maybe you should always talk, 5 minutes of the podcast with that thing in your mouth.
Oh, there you go.
And then see if people can identify who this is.
All right, there was still a little bit left, my mistake, but now my hands are all greasy and edit this podcast. So anyway, we're going to tune out now. Thanks, Jack, for filling in while I had this thing under my tongue. Mike, Jacob, and John, and thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.